This is 4:55 on Wednesday, September 25th. Good morning. Are there any questions about technical, procedural, programming? No questions. All right. Please sign in for attendance. I do collect those every day and send them off to the TA to record, so it's important that you do that when you're here. All right. So we were talking about TCP congestion control, and we just have a little bit left to do, which has to do with fairness of this, and we'll talk about what that means. But I realized that I hadn't really emphasized enough that if you understand what's going on, fully understand what's going on in this picture, you will have a great understanding of TCP congestion control, what it does, and if you understand the mechanisms that cause this behavior, you will also understand how it works. So, I think there's a homework problem that pertains to this picture as well. Ask you to interpret something that looks like that. So, very important to understand that. I don't want to do this. Much more important to understand that picture than this one. All right, that's the point. Okay, that. All right. So we were about to talk about fairness when we ran out of time. So here's the dilemma or the issue. We have multiple senders sending through a congested link or a bottleneck link, and they're both running TCP. And the question is, do the two TCP connections eventually end up sharing that available bandwidth fairly, that is equally, or does one of them end up dominating? And what's interesting about this is that it is a goal of TCP to ensure that they end up sharing fairly. Some earlier protocols, such as ones that we developed in the Xerox corporate internet, did not have this fair sharing property, and certain kinds of behavior on the part of certain connections would cause those connections to dominate what was being sent over the bottleneck link to the exclusion of others, and that's really not a very nice behavior to have in your network, right? If somebody can sort of behave in a certain way and dominate the connection, you don't want that. So, the question is, does TCP achieve fair sharing? And to understand this, the authors of the book have developed this picture that if you understand, again, this is another picture that if you understand the picture, you will sort of understand why it works the way it does. So, to interpret the picture, every point in this diagram corresponds to a certain level of throughput by connection 2 and connection 1. Right? So the vertical position is the throughput on connection 2, and the horizontal position of that point is throughput on connection 1. So the sum total of the two has to be less than or equal to R, so this blue line is the limit of how far they can go. And they're going at equal rates it corresponds to points on this 45 degree line. Okay, so assume we start out in a state where they're not sharing equally. Okay, so both of them are using additive increase at that point. We'll presume they start with using additive increase because that's what they're doing almost all the time, except when congestion occurs. So they sort of march upward toward this blue line, and maybe somebody gets ahead of that. And when it does, congestion occurs, and whoever notices the congestion, which is more likely to be the guy who's sending fast, went the wrong direction. Whoever notices that, in this case, the guy who's number one, right? He's the one who's going faster. He notices the congestion and cuts his sending rate by half. Right? So the pair of them, therefore, sort of move back. Well, actually, I guess the diagram shows both of them moving back, cutting by half, and so they come back to this point. Is there a fly in here or something?
A wasp?
Yeah. Oh, okay.
That's why I'm flailing around.
Yeah, you don't really want him to hang around, do you? Anybody got a swatter? I don't think they equip the roof with a fly swatter. What?
You don't
want to swat them. Oh, yeah. Well, you want to, if you swat them, you want to swat them to termination, shall we say. So they both cut back half, but that means that the faster guy cuts back by a whole lot more than the slower guy does. Okay? And so then you resume, there's no more congestion, and you resume, and they keep in both increasing at the same rate, and again you get congestion, and again you cut back by half. And you see that as this goes, they get closer and closer to the asymptotic line where they're sharing equal rate. So that's pretty cool. And in fact, this works across... Whoa, my turn. Oh, gee. Likes you, Adam. Get it? No.
Is it on my shoe?
Yeah. Okay. All right. Applause for our hero. All right. So in fact, this works when there are multiple senders as well, and they converge on equal shares. Okay. So... So the problem is that this is all well and good if you're doing TCP, but if you're doing UDP, there's no congestion control mechanism in the system. And people typically don't implement congestion control in their application layer uses of UDP either, although there is in the Internet RFCs, you can find discussions of what's called TCP-friendly protocols, which mean that they, in fact, do pay attention to congestion and sort of play along with TCP nicely. So it has been done, but you know, naive implementation of just blast things away can lead to worries about that congestion collapse that we talked about last time. Okay? So I think that's all I wanted to say about fairness. Oh, well, there's a whole slide about this, actually. So do not want rate for... Okay, so this is really... Multimedia apps often do not use TCP. They do not want their rate throttled by congestion control. Well, that's just being unfriendly, right? That's being rude. It's okay to send at a constant rate and tolerate loss, but you really should at least pay attention in some way to congestion, because if you're causing congestion with your streams, if there's congestion already in the network, it doesn't help you at all to keep blasting away at high rates. Yeah.
Do you know if applications like Netflix use
I've been told they use TCP, but it surprises me.
There's a big chunk of the internet usage by
is YouTube and Netflix and Hulu and all those things. And so that might be a interesting little investigation at this point to start up. We haven't talked about Wireshark, have we? We talked about Wireshark? No. Okay. We'll talk about Wireshark soon. Start up Wireshark, take a look at the traffic that you're getting for some of these applications and say, is it TCP or UDP? Okay? Okay. So even in the case that you are using TCP, there are ways to cheat. Suppose I am an application that I'm talking to somebody else and I'm not satisfied with my fair share. I can open up multiple TCP connections, and as far as the TCP operation is concerned, my multiple connections will each get a share. Right? So the shares get a little bit smaller when I add one, but I get more of them. And so that's cheating when you do it that way. Now, web browsers do this, do open multiple connections sometimes, but it's not for the purpose of cheating congestion control. It's for other reasons that they want to get parallelism in the retrieval from the server. That's not really considered cheating, it's not being done for the purpose of cheating, but it can cause all the problems that cheating would cause if those are, in fact, high-rate data streams. Typically, they're not, right? You're retrieving something of fairly finite size. It happens and it goes away. So, but the good thing is that at least when you're cheating by getting parallel TCP connections, all of them will obey the congestion control rules and not lead to congestion collapse, even though some people may be getting more than a fair share by that way. Okay, so we've talked about transport layer. We've done the port stuff. We've done reliable data transfer. We've distinguished between flow control and congestion control. We've talked about how it works in the internet. And now we need to talk about the network itself, which is the next chapter, which is chapter 4. Yes. So let me stop for questions, comments, any thoughts about how what you've learned about the transport layer affects what you know about what happens when you use the network? Any? Any thoughts about that? Yes, I could tell that you were formulating something.
Over coaxial cable, which most internet providers use for internet.
At least coaxial cable is used by cable.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Cable providers. Yeah.
Anyway, is that converted to a different packet or control or protocol when it's then sent to the distribution center? I'm just wondering how TCP interacts with ISPs.
Okay, sure. So, which picture to go back to? Back to the beginning of this chapter. This picture. So that coaxial cable is sort of at the data link and physical layer. So what's going to happen is the TCP or UDP packets with their application data and the TCP headers are going to get stuffed into IP packets with IP headers on the front of what was already there, and then passed down to the data link layer where another set of headers is put on. So it isn't that they really get converted. They get encapsulated. And then those things come off at different, those headers come off at different points. And so the TCP packets that you send from here end up arriving intact over here, but the network, well, the network headers get transformed as it goes, and in a sort of mild way, not too severely, and the data link headers get stripped off and reattached at every step of the way. Okay?
So where does TCP congestion control interact within the IP?
Within all this, yeah, this picture? Sure. That's a great question. So TCP congestion control is implemented entirely here and here. Okay? And the signals that it receives about whether there's congestion or not are sort of inferred from the fact that at this router, say, a packet was dropped due to congestion. Okay? That shows up at the endpoint as a packet didn't arrive, an expected packet didn't arrive, which leads to duplicate acknowledgments or no acknowledgments, which are then interpreted by the implementation over on this side as congestion.
So the intermediate routers are kind of the ones that look at those, so they strip the data link stuff off, look at the TCP, and then repackage it?
They actually don't have to look at the TCP at all.
They
are really completely oblivious to the fact that it's TCP. Packet disappears, and that's the signal that TCP gets. Which is pretty interesting, actually, that in this sort of huge network, the routers can just be completely oblivious to what's happening, how they're being used. Now, we're going to talk next about the network layer, and we'll see that that isn't always the case. That there are kinds of networks where the routers will be involved in stuff like that. So, this is the chapter 4. So we've tended to talk about the different layers in terms of the service models that they provide. What can the thing above them in the stack rely on from them? So that's the service model. We'll talk about that for the networks. We'll talk about the definition of the term forwarding versus the term routing. So we talk about routers, but in fact, they're all the interesting performance constraints come in their forwarding role, not in their routing role, which we'll see when we see how it works. We'll talk about routing algorithms. So how do the routers collectively figure out where packets should go? And we'll talk about broadcast and multicast networks. And then we'll talk about the internet. So just to review then, the goal of the network layer is to transport data from host to host. The transport layer worries about making sure that data gets from the host receiving point up to the correct application. So the terminology we're now going to use is that the transport layer produces segments, which are plopped by the network layer into datagrams. I try to be consistent about this, but I'm not sure that I succeed all the time. It's easy to get sloppy and just call them all packets sometimes. Okay, so the receiving side strips the segments out of the datagrams to give up to the transport layer. So unlike the transport layer protocols, the network layer protocols run in all of the hosts, whether they're end hosts or routers, or every device has implementation of the network layer protocols. And we'll talk about how routers look at datagrams and determine what to do with them. Oh, it's very busy. Okay. But the whole point here is that the end hosts have the transport and application layers, and everything else has only network at the bottom. Which is a bit of a lie, because we're going to see that, in fact, the intermediate stuff use application layer protocols like DNS and the routing protocols to do their work. But they're not part of the normal processing of every packet. So they have implementations of those higher level protocols. They're just not used in processing every packet that comes there. Okay. Thank you. All right. Some graduate student got paid to do that, I guess. What? Yeah. Okay. So, distinguishing forwarding and routing. So, forwarding is the process by which a router takes a packet that comes into it and decides which output to send it on. That's forwarding. And because forwarding happens for every incoming packet, the whole goal of companies like Cisco and Juniper Networks and Packet Engines and these companies that build high-end routing equipment, their whole engineering goal is to make forwarding go fast. That's the bottleneck there. Routing is the process by which routers figure out what to put in the tables that guide the forwarding. Okay, and it takes place on a much longer time scale, much slower time scale, because routing involves discussion amongst routers about where things should go, what's the topology of the network, and so forth. So that's the high level description. The illustration is like so. The routing algorithm sets up the tables, incoming. I'm supposed to point this out. So an incoming packet has something in its destination header that says 011. You look it up in here and it says, oh, send that one out, number 2. Very simple. How to go fast? What are the issues in going fast? Mainly that all of the data that comes in here has to be sort of processed through the electronics, the buses, the processors, and so forth, of this device before it can be sent out there. That's one issue. And the second issue is that these tables themselves can get to be very huge, so the cost of this lookup may be non-trivial. Those are the two big things there. Okay, so routing and forwarding are sort of essential in any sort of network. In certain kinds of networks, there's also the issue of setting up a connection before data actually flows. Now remember that we talked about TCP having connections, right? But the connections for TCP are simply an agreement between the two end hosts. They have nothing to do with what's happening inside the network. The IP network has no awareness of connections. But other networks do, like ATM is one, Frame Relay, X25, there's just a bunch of these things which all get used to some extent to implement low levels of the internet. They get used to implement sort of pseudo link layers and below. Yeah. What is X25? X25 is a fairly ancient networking protocol that you probably can still buy X25 services from telephone companies, but I suspect it's largely been supplanted by these things called frame relay and ATM. So in these kinds of networks, before you can send data, the two end hosts and everything in between have to establish what's called a virtual connection. The routers are involved in that, and by the time you're done, you have a reserved path between the source and the destination. IP doesn't do that. So again, just distinguishing, networks have connections between hosts, in these cases, transport layers between processes. Okay, so then we said, what is the service model of the network layer, and the kinds of things you would like to be in the service model are answers to the questions about, does it guarantee delivery? So I send something in, does it come out? That's part of the service model. The answer can be yes or no. Another thing that's in the service model is, how long does it take? I put something in, when does it come out? A number, or a distribution, or you can answer that question in different ways. That pertains to individual datagrams. You can also ask questions about service for a whole flow of datagrams, one after another. Do they come out in the same order that you put them in? Yes or no? Part of the service model. If I put a bunch of them in, how long does it take for them to get there? Bandwidth. And if I put a bunch of them in at a certain rate, you know, and I like for video or audio, you're going to be sending packets regularly, do they come out with that same inter-packet spacing, or do they get bunched up or stretched out, or what happens? So, here's a comparison of two different network architectures, the internet and the ATM, which stands for asynchronous transfer mode, and that's just phone company jargon, as far as we're concerned. The asynchronous is very weird because it's much more synchronous than the network. You know, very weird terminology, but phone company jargon. And within ATM, there's the possibility of users of the service specifying different service models. So ATM supports many different service models. The internet supports only one. And the internet's service model is called best effort delivery. And that simply means that you put a packet into the network and it's free to throw it away. It's free to delay it. It's free to do whatever it wants to do with that packet. There are no guarantees about what it will do. On the other hand, it's best effort because everybody works hard, sort of from both a technical perspective in terms of the routers and from a business perspective in terms of the people who own the resources of the internet, to make sure that packets are in fact delivered with high probability, because if you have an internet service provider that is prone to throwing away a lot of traffic, it will not be a successful business, right? So, best effort, we make good effort, and we achieve sort of very high delivery rates, but there are no guarantees about bandwidth, there's no guarantees about loss. We're free to reorder the packets, and we're free to stretch them and so forth. Yep. It's amazing that it works. That you can build good stuff out of something that seems really pretty crappy. And it provides no congestion feedback except this loss stuff that we talked about in answer to Isaac's questions earlier. The ATM has different models, so-called constant bit rate, variable bit rate, available bit rate, and undetermined bit rate or unassigned bit rate. And you can see different answers to these different guarantees. But what's interesting is that one that I particularly wanted to point out was this one, where all the ATM answers are the same. They're all yes. Why is that in relation to the internet where the answer is no? Well, those are all yes because ATM in every case is using a virtual connection oriented protocol, and just inherently as part of the way that works, every packet goes across the same routers, and the routers guarantee not to reorder them internally. And if you have that, those two things, you get all the packets in the same order that you sent them. So that's, you know, that's one easy way to distinguish connection oriented versus no connection oriented. All right, so datagram networks are connectionless, virtual circuit networks are connection oriented. I guess the main point of these three is that you don't get to choose. The network is one way or the other. Okay. It's just inherent in the technology. And its implementation is certainly in the network core and may extend out to the end hosts. So virtual circuits are just what they sound like, essentially electrical circuits that are things that look like electrical circuits. And we talked about this in Chapter 1, right? That the idea of a virtual circuit network is to provide something that's very much like picking up the telephone and having an electrical circuit completed between you and the other end. Now, even so-called POTS service, plain old telephone service these days, doesn't work that way. But for a long time it did. And so that's why you would... Do you ever watch old black and white movies from the 30s? People make long distance calls, a long distance call from Philadelphia to New York, and people are yelling into the telephone because the people at the other end can't hear because it's a circuit. You know, your microphone is connected to their speaker. Okay, so virtual circuits, you have to go through this call setup phase. Now, to implement the virtualness of this, what happens is that we put in each packet an identifier that says which virtual circuit does this packet belong to. And we don't put in virtual circuit networks, the end address. The end address has already been taken care of by the fact that we did this call setup. So during call setup, I say, who do I want to connect to? 509-335-6470. You know, you say that at the beginning of your telephone call, and thereafter, once that connection is set up, you just send data. It knows where it's going because you're sending it on a particular virtual circuit. And as the packets flow through the network, then the routers, remember that table lookup idea in the routers for forwarding, the routers look at the virtual circuit identifier to determine what output link to send things on, and we'll see something else about that here in a second, and everything's reserved, so you can get predictable service out of this. I think I've said all this, except I haven't said this. I'm going to say this and then we'll move on and look at the illustration, and this is clearer in the illustration, but I want to say it anyway. The virtual circuit number that's contained in the packet can be changed at every step along the way as it moves from one router to the next. It can change the virtual circuit number. Why? Because during call setup, we arrange it to be so. Right? It's just a bookkeeping problem to say, what virtual circuit number should this flow have on this link? So it's easier to see here. So a forwarding table in a virtual circuit router looks like this. It maps It's a lookup table in which the keys are the incoming interface number or identity and the incoming virtual circuit number. So this comes out of the packet, and this comes out of the fact that you know where the packet arrived, just in the router. And so you take those two things, you look them up, and what you get as an answer is the outgoing interface number and the outgoing virtual circuit number. So you just replace the incoming virtual circuit number with the outgoing one as you send the packet onward. So you see, this idea that you can switch the virtual circuit numbers is really no issue at all. It's a simple lookup, and that you have to do essentially anyway to get the outgoing interface, so you might as well get an outgoing virtual circuit number. Now, why do they do this? Why do they let the virtual circuit number change? Why not just use the same one across the whole path? Any ideas? No. Not security. Conflict avoidance. Right? Suppose I had already it may be hard to see. This may not be a good illustration. Yeah, this will do. So suppose I had already set up something that used virtual circuit 12 across this path, and for some reason, virtual circuit 12 was a good thing to use on this path, on this link, to get to this host. If I had to ensure that the same virtual circuit number were used everywhere, I would have to not use virtual circuit 12 on this link. But there's no reason not to use virtual circuit 12 on that link, right? It's free on that link. It's just occupied on that one. So in order to avoid sort of complicated bookkeeping problems that would ensue from having to try to figure out what was a free number that I could use along the whole path, it's easier to just pick a locally good number at each stage and remap it. In our research, we were doing something sort of similar to this, and I'm not convinced that I have convinced the people, the students working on this, that they really need to implement this. They keep wanting to use global identifiers, but you don't need to use global identifiers, and not using global identifiers is easy and cheap, and you ought to do it. So, in addition to the data sending protocols that you have through these networks, you also have to have protocols for the routers or switches and end hosts to talk to each other about what they want to do in order to set up a connection. So, when you want to make a telephone call, your telephone has to tell the switch here, according to a particular protocol, who it wants to talk to. And this switch then has to figure out what other switch to talk to and tell that switch what we're doing here. So there are defined protocols for that. But the end hosts typically are only minimally involved in that. They just say what they want to do to the first guy here, and it gets taken care of down the road. Oh, I see. Magical things are happening. Thank you. And it works. These networks were defined by the telephone company. So it works very much like a telephone call. You make one of these. You make this initiation message. It goes through the network. It shows up at the other end, and your computer says yes or no. I will answer that call or reject it. I worked on one of these networks once upon a time, and it was pretty bizarre. Pretty bizarre. Very complicated. IP is much, much easier to conceptualize it, to implement. But anyway, so it says, yes, I'll accept that call, send it back, and then finally we can start sending data. Okay. So datagram networks are a lot simpler, as you've probably gathered by now. You just start sending the data into the network. The routers have sort of figured out ahead of time where good places to send datagrams will be, and they do that thing. And sometimes packets flow over one path, sometimes they flow over a different path. All is allowed. So for datagram forwarding, the forwarding table is different, and the forwarding rules are different. Here, because things are not always flowing over the same path, we have to keep track of what the destination is at all times. So it's always the case that as this datagram flows through the network, its destination is part of the header. That's what the routers are going to be looking at. What the routers do is they look up the destination address in their forwarding table, which is now a lot simpler. It just has address ranges and output links. All it has to have. Now, one issue about all this is that for IPv4, with 32-bit addresses, there are roughly 4 billion addresses available. And certainly in the early days of the network, you could not afford to have a 4 billion table entry. Even today, you can't really afford to have a 4 billion entry table here. And you can't afford to look up things in a 4 billion entry table, really. Well, you might be able to. So we need to come up with schemes to compress this table and not have one entry for every possible destination. The other thing is you might be able to store it, but you certainly couldn't negotiate it. You couldn't pass for 16 gigabytes of information to all your neighbors to tell them what you knew about, and that's going to be one of the steps. So we have to have ways to aggregate the addresses here, and the way we do it is by having these be address ranges. So you say these addresses go to there, and then starting at one more than that, go to there, and etc. Okay, and you could have an otherwise case, a default route, if you will. And then the other thing that the internet has come to do in the last 15 years or so is to allow there to be sort of boundaries here within the routing tables where you say, I'll take, you know, things that match the destination address by this much, and I don't care about the rest of the bits, go to that particular interface. And then the rule is that when an incoming packet arrives, you have to look for the longest match. So suppose the destination address here is 0010. 0010 matches this rule. But 00011 matches both this rule and this rule. But we go on and say, oh, it also matches 000 there. That's longer. So this is the one we pick. Okay? So that allows compression of the routing tables still farther, because I don't have to spell out all the different cases for these three like I would in the other one. Okay, so which one should we pick? The world has settled largely on this one, hasn't it? It's simple inside the network, but it assumes that the things at the edges are capable computers. ATM was developed by the telephone companies. They thought that the telephones would be stupid devices, relatively stupid devices, and therefore there would have to be lots of complexity inside the network to make it work. Well, as we all know, telephones today are smarter than the computers for which this was designed. So they handle this just fine. However, ATM is nice in some ways because of the service model that it has. It has these guaranteed rate properties. It has the in-order delivery properties. And it makes a very nice sort of component inside an IP network. It can serve as the link layer for the IP network layer. And a lot of the backbone of the internet actually runs over ATM links because the companies that spend money on them can control how much bandwidth is allocated for any given purpose. They can sell different pieces of it to different people in ways that you can't do with IP. So ATM has actually succeeded, but not for the reasons that it was invented. Kind of an interesting state of affairs. Yes?
So ATM is then also very more stable?
ATM is more stable in some sense, yes. This connection setup stuff is sufficiently painful that even in the background, even in the backbone of the internet, the connections they set up are connections that they set up and leave up for months or years, right? And they isolate traffic that way. Lots of good things can happen when you do that. But they have it's really interesting that they put all this complexity in there. But it was so complex that it could only be used really, really in the core of the network, and not because the edges were dumb, but because because you needed that to sort of provide economically viable service. Okay, I think that's a good place to stop. So we will. On Friday, we will answer any questions about the homework, so please look at the homework before Friday, and we will do exam review as well for the exam coming up on Monday. That's the plan. Chapter 4 will not be on the exam.